New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Emmy Vadnais, co-host with Jeffrey Mishlov. Our topic today is pain relief and healing with energy medicine with my guest, Eric Leskowitz, who also goes by Rick. He has recently retired after serving as a consultant psychiatrist for over 25 years with the pain management program at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital in Boston, where he also founded the Integrative Medicine Task Force. He holds an appointment as a research affiliate with the Osher Institute for Integrative Medicine Research at Harvard Medical School. Rick has been studying energy healing, meditation, and hypnosis for over 40 years, presenting workshops on the integration of subtle energy techniques and theories with the allopathic medical model. He has written over 50 articles being published in leading scientific journals. He is author of The Mystery of Life Energy, Biofield Healing, Phantom Limbs, Group Energetics, and Gaia Consciousness, and The Joy of Socks, Weird Science and the Power of Intention, Sports, Spirituality, and Science Come Together at the Old Ball Game, which was also made into a documentary film. He is editor of Sports, Energy, and Consciousness, Awakening Human Potential Through Sport, Complementary and Alternative Medicine and Rehabilitation, and Transpersonal Hypnotherapy, Gateway to Body, Mind, and Spirit. If you enjoy this program, please like, subscribe, press the bell icon, and share. Rick is joining us from Buckland, Massachusetts. Now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Rick. It's a great pleasure to have you with me on New Thinking Aloud today.
Thanks, Emmy. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Well, you've had a full career as a physician, psychiatrist, specializing in rehabilitation, pain management, and also with a nice healthy dose of energy medicine. How did you first become interested in energy medicine?
Well, it actually was a bit of a journey, as the cliche goes, because when I started out, my upbringing was very opposed to any of these, you know, woo-woo type of things. My father was a research scientist in the early days of immunology, and his background was chemistry. And so what substances can you inject in a rat to make them generate T cells and things like that? So it's really, really hard science. And I loved it. I was really fascinated by it. And I happened to be good at math and science. So that was, you know, my focus in school. I was, I guess you would say, something of a nerd. My perspective opened a little bit by going away to college, and that's sort of what college is designed to do. And I happened to be alive and in college during the years of the anti-war protests in the late 60s, early 70s. So, I mean, politically that was important, but sort of psychologically for me, that was the whole thing about questioning authority. And at first, you know, it was political authority that was being questioned. But then I realized that, you know, authority shows itself in other ways too, including how we look at the world. You know, I was a biology major. I took a few courses in neuroscience. I was just developing them. But I thought, you know, neurotransmitters could explain everything. We just needed to know a little bit more about it. And I wasn't totally psyched on medical school. I thought there seemed to be more to it than that. So fortunately, I took a couple of years off before going back to medical school. And in that time, I traveled overseas, and it was really an excellent decision, not just because I met my wife and that, but just we traveled to some other countries, and we did overland to India, not as a spiritual pilgrimage, but just to see. And it was really literally an eye-opener because things are different in different countries. And even medicine, they don't do it the same way we do it. So that was actually my first experience to anything energetic because there was she had some back pain and had acupuncture treatment for that. And also, we've spent a couple of days at an ashram of one of the better known gurus, teachers there. And he did a session for the group where his treatment was to look at people just for 2 seconds or something like that. And that was, you know, whatever it was supposed to do. Ironically, subconsciously or whatever, at the instant that he looked at me, I blinked. So I didn't get the transmission, but just the concept of it, that energy of some sort could be transmitted just by looking at somebody, was very unusual. So we came back. I did medical school, but I was something of an outlier because I had stepped away for a while. And you could say I got off the treadmill. I've more recently come to think of it as the trance was broken, that there is a definite way that you're programmed to think of the world in a certain way. And from the medical point of view, it's what's called the mechanistic or materialistic point of view, that human beings are very complicated machines, but we're just an assemblage of certain parts and subunits. And if there's something wrong, you take it apart, you put in a new micro whatever here, and for whatever reason, things are better again. And, you know, obviously that approach works for a lot of things, especially the surgical angle. I like to joke that I did tear a ligament in my knee a while back, and I spent about a day trying to meditate it away, but I wasn't making any progress. And so I had surgery because, you know, in some situations, that's the right thing to do. But it wasn't the full picture. And my big dissatisfaction with medical school was so much was unexplained. And they admitted it, but they... You know, the thing about medicine, that part of its aura and the authority that comes from it is using a specialized language that most people don't understand. And they had a word to describe the fact that they didn't know what was going on. It was called a disease that they didn't understand. It was called idiopathic, which on the one hand, it does sound impressive. But if you break it down into its roots, you know, it comes from the same Greek root word as idiot that we don't understand. So that, you know, the promise was just stay with it and eventually we'll figure everything out. We'll break it down into, you know, genes or neurotransmitters or something and put it all together and it'll work. But it didn't really fit. So psychiatry was the closest thing I could find to get at these different levels, because I had some experience with altered states of consciousness in college. And so, you know, I was fortunate to find a good psychiatry program with some of the leaders in what's called psychoneuroimmunology, the idea that, you know, stress can affect immune function, which was a radical idea at the time. And, you know, I tried to build on that. In medical school, I had actually learned how to meditate just before medical school, the TM approach, and was trying to apply it to all the different diseases that we were studying, but there was no literature. There was zero on, or two studies on meditation and health and illness. So again, that was, it needed some development. Ironically, the place I went to medical school, University of Massachusetts, was where a young research scientist was doing luncheon presentations on his sort of hobby of meditation. This was Jon Kabat-Zinn, before he was anybody. I mean, he was not, you know what I mean. But and it was a couple of medical students helped him connect with primary care docs so he could begin to do some clinical work, because he was saying, you know, it feels wonderful. I wonder what it would do with patients. So his first study was chronic pain. So, you know, looking back now, whatever this is, 45 years later, it's just astounding to see what he's done and what that center has done, because there's literally thousands of studies on meditation now. So that part has grown, the mind-body part. And that was pretty satisfying for a lot of reasons for a long time. Things changed for me when a friend of mine who I trusted invited me to a visiting lecture by a healer, which was a term that pressed all my buttons because it was so against my background of, you know, science was the be all and end all, and also being at least culturally Jewish, not observant, but, you know, healing was the laying on of hands and Jesus, and it was stuff that we just didn't accept or believe in. So it's only because I trusted Richard that I went to the lecture, and it was Reverend Rosalind Bruyere from California, and she was a healer and a clairvoyant, medical intuitive, all those buzzwords that turned me off, but she worked with the doctors in Los Angeles and had a good reputation because she could diagnose and treat the situations that the doctors couldn't handle. So I gave it a shot. And within 5 minutes, I knew that this lady knew more about the true causes of health and illness than my medical school faculty. It was like, you could just tell. And it was wow. So I, you know, luckily at that time, she was coming to Massachusetts twice a year to do 5-day intensives. And so I signed up, and for 6-7 years, that's what I did every May and October. And wow, it was just a whole different vision of what being human is, really. And, you know, I was with a group of about 40 other people. You know, some were trained clinicians, many were lay people who just had an interest in it. And we learned different hands-on energy healing techniques. And, you know, it sounded good, but when you feel it for the first time, when somebody does a treatment on you, it's like, what was that? She only had her hands on my shoulders, but my whole body was, you know, that kind of thing. And it's really, I think it's really important to have that kind of experience to sort of get a sense of why people are so excited about it. I have to admit, it was a very humbling experience to go through that training too, because in many ways, in terms of energetic perception and ability and all, I was the dumbest kid in the class. And that was a new experience for me. So it took me a while to get sort of attuned, I guess would be the word. But I began to use those ideas and approaches in my clinical work. And I was, I was still at the VA. I didn't have enough sort of confidence in it to integrate any of that into the clinical work there. But a job opened up at Spalding Rehabilitation in their pain management program, which this was about like 1990. A very innovative program because they did not use the standard approach of let's find a new injection or a nerve block or medication. It was actually the opposite. They tried to taper people off as many of those approaches as possible and teach instead self-management so people could be more functional in their everyday life. And the emphasis wasn't on how bad is your pain today or where is your pain today. It's like, how far could you walk and things like that. And it was a team approach, which was really the key. It was, we had physical therapists, occupational therapists, that I know you're an occupational therapist. I actually did not know what an occupational therapist, what it even was when I started, because, you know, my training had been so narrow that it just hadn't occurred to me, but it turns out they were the key to the program actually. And We had a lot of mental health input with a psychologist, psychiatrist. And initially it was a inpatient program that they stayed for a month so they could taper off the narcotics and really get immersed in all these approaches. Over the years, insurance companies have sort of tightened the screws and we had to switch to a less intensive outpatient program, which is good, but it's not as great as this. And it's sort of, as an aside, it's like one of the problems with medicine is from the insurance company point of view, they would be paying, I think it was like $30,000 for the month's treatment, which was an expense right up front. It didn't register that the savings down the road would be 10 times that. They were so focused on short term that was all they understood. So, but that's, you know, that's part of the problem with healthcare as a business that America is facing. But with chronic pain patients, there's a sense that doctors don't have all the answers and we can try new things and patients are very willing to try new things. So that was really, it turned out to be an ideal forum for doing these energy-based approaches. I had had some training initially in therapeutic touch, which I think was the first of the energy-based hands-on energy approaches that made it into the medical setting because it was geared for nurses. It was designed for nurses to use. And just as a quick aside, because it's so interesting, the idea is that human beings have an energy field, what lay people call an aura, and the scientific term now is a biofield. You don't know exactly what the components of it are, but you don't edit your skin. And there's a space around you where you have some kind of sphere of influence. And, you know, I think everybody's experienced it when somebody's into your personal space, for example. Some people are very sensitive to that. There are many exercises that you can do to develop sensitivity. Like, for example, just a quick one that viewers can, yeah, right. If you put your hands far apart, you don't feel anything. As they come closer without touching, you go back and forth at some distance, and it's different for everybody. For me right now, it's about here. I can feel something in between, and sometimes it's more of a tingle. Sometimes it's like a literal pressure that you feel like you're pressing against something, and it's a very simple indicator of your biofield's existence, because what I understand it to be and what people say is that, you know, there's a boundary here and a boundary here. When you go like this, the two boundaries are literally bumping into each other and you can feel it. And it's actually very interesting to use it as a informal kind of diagnostic tool of how am I feeling today? Because on days when, you know, it's beautiful out and I just had a nice walk and talking about things I need to talk about, my hands are further apart. On days when it's kind of, you know, I have to get like this close before I feel anything. So over the years, I've convinced myself it's not the power of suggestion, that there's something legitimate there. So that's the first step in therapeutic touch intervention, is to feel out the boundary. And then they go ahead and smooth it out and clear out the energy kinks. And in a minute, I'll talk about what that led to in terms of my understanding of chronic pain. But just there's a very interesting historical note. Go into it more in the book, but therapeutic touch wasn't the first time that the energy at a distance was smoothed out. There was a very well-known / notorious Austrian physician from the 1780s and 90s named Franz Mesmer, who got known for working with what he called animal magnetism. And this was at a time when, you know, electricity and magnetism were just being discovered, you know, Benjamin Franklin with his kite and the lightning bolts and things like that. So people were fascinated by it. There were stones called lodestones that were natural magnets, and Mesmer was really interested in that and what effect that would have on people. And he took the next step, and, you know, if stones can have it, what about humans having magnetism? So he actually cultivated his own magnetism and worked with patients by doing this kind of smoothing out. They were called mesmeric passes. And he ended up in Paris, where all the very wealthy aristocratic patients were gravitating towards him and away from the conventional doctors. So they couldn't have that. So they had him investigated, and there was a royal commission, and they did actually some very cool kinds of blindfolding, basically, to see if people could tell whether it was legit or not. But there was problems with what we would now call the experimenter effect, because Mesmer wasn't the mesmerizer. It was somebody who was basically told, you can't stay in the medical society if you are an advocate for mesmerism. And so he literally couldn't prove it to be effective. So the verdict was in. It was all power of suggestion. And Mesmer was kind of run out of town. And, you know, his reputation has never recovered, even though, in my view, he was just a couple of centuries ahead of his time. Because now magnetism, you know, there are therapies where you put magnets on different parts of the body, and the field is used and studied. So he was too far ahead of his time, I think, and he really took a hit. Took one for the team, if you will. But his you know, biofield or animal magnetism piece is legit. So in my clinical work, I started using that. It ended up not being my most favorite technique, but I'll talk about it more because it really opened something up. I ended up really valuing a technique based on the acupuncture meridians, not so much the field itself. And people may be familiar. Actually, I hope they are, but it's kind of interesting. I don't know how widely disseminated this information is, but the idea that people can tap their own acupuncture points while they're thinking about ups to the point where they can release it and not be triggered by it. And just in a nutshell, it leads to the sensation that we've all had that when something, you know, we get something off our chest and then we go, ooh, like that. It feels great. And I think it's, if I could see energy, that's, I'm pretty sure that's what it would be, was all that old, stuck, stagnant energy being released. So this became my go-to treatment for chronic pain.
Before we move away from the history, you also gave a presentation on Franz Mesmer that sort of helped his name in history.
Yeah, this was a kind of an interesting moment. Mesmerism died out, even though it could be demonstrated. There was a British naval surgeon in the 1840s who did surgical anesthesia using these mesmeric passes. And there were actually mesmeric infirmaries, even though Mesmer had been, you know, run out of town. But it all changed. I should know the date. I think it was like 1845 when ether anesthesia was introduced, actually at the Mass General Hospital, where my hospital is affiliated with, where, you know, within seconds you could induce complete deep surgical anesthesia, and it very quickly overtook mesmeric passes, and that was the end of that era. The demonstration was done in the surgical amphitheater of Mass General that became known as the Ether Dome, because it was dome-shaped, and because that's where ether was introduced. And it's also been the site of, you know, it's a lecture, it's a great lecture setting, because it's got these very steeply raked seats, and it's very, you know, it evokes history. So, as I said, my hospital is affiliated with Mass General, and they had a regular pain management series of lectures. So I gave a talk on Mesmer and the history of hypnosis and pain management, and it was delivered at this site. And so for me to be talking about the value of animal magnetism in the setting where animal magnetism was erased, I was probably the only one who felt it, but it was really, it was very moving, actually, in a way to sort of like reclaim the territory or something and help to restore his name, because I really do think Mesmer was not properly honored by history. So that was actually a very cool thing to have done. I mean, there's a lot of the history of energy medicine in the West that's very interesting. Another one is a well-known psychiatrist who was a student of Sigmund Freud, actually, who initially was working in Germany on what he called orgone energy. He thought there was an invisible energy that was the secret to health and illness, and it was totally sexual in nature, so he called it orgone energy. And it was an uncomfortable time in Germany anyway, because it was Jewish, but also the topic was not popular. So he came to America. His name was Wilhelm Reich, and he ended up in Maine, actually, doing research. He developed very simple devices that could collect this energy. There's a picture in the book of what was called a orgone box that accumulated energy just by it was just layers of wood and metal alternating. Shouldn't do anything, but people talk about profound effects of it. And he even began to use it to affect the weather and treat cancer. And he ran into trouble with the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and they put up all sorts of bureaucratic hurdles and obstacles, and he was a little bit of a rebel, so he didn't comply. So he was actually arrested and imprisoned. They burned his books. This was in the mid-1950s. They burned his books. This was, you know, the same time as McCarthyism and the Red Scare and all that. So it was just this aura of fear was permeating everywhere. And this poor man, he actually died in prison waiting for his parole hearing. And, you know, it sounds so primitive to think about book burning, although nowadays there are some trends in our society that are heading in that direction of censoring and banning. But so, you know, again, he went a little bit too far and touched a raw nerve. There's been a lot of development as a result of his work on what's called body-centered psychotherapy, looking at the importance of the body in holding in stress and trauma. And the classic text now on post-traumatic stress is Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps Score, and that's literally an outgrowth of what Wilhelm Reich was in prison for. So things change. It's just got to be patient. One other historical note is very recent, is the tapping therapies that I mentioned. That one's called EFT, Emotional Freedom Techniques, but it's under the umbrella of energy psychology. And there's a professional organization, a national professional organization, the Association for Comprehensive Energy Psychology. Over 1,000 people with graduate level training, PhDs, MDs, you know, social workers, OTs, PTs, what have you. So it's you know, been around for a while, and we pride ourselves on our research and clinical trainings and things like that. But we were always troubled by the way that Wikipedia discussed energy psychology in their entry, because they used terms like, you know, pseudoscience and quackery and things like that, and it just, you know, it wasn't true. So we would add, because everybody can be their own editor, we would add citations for the newest research and literature onto the site, and within a day it would be edited out again. It would be disappeared. So, you know, we wondered what was going on, and I don't know who had the idea, but to make a petition within our organization and beyond. We got over like 10,000 signatures through the change.org website for them to address it. But we didn't really know what was going to happen. And much to our surprise, the president of our organization got an email from Jimmy Wales. He's the man who's the head of Wikipedia. He founded it and he runs it. And he was very offended that we would doubt their scientific credibility and credentials. And he just used some language that was very, very inappropriate in terms of how he described us. We're 1,000 trained, accredited clinicians, and he's some, you know, guy. I don't actually know what his background was. But he said, you know, we'll stand by our judgments until you can come up with scientific evidence, and we will not be swayed by the opinion of lunatic charlatans. That's the actual term that he called us, lunatic charlatans. And it was like, so off the wall. We really didn't even know how to respond. We haven't had any luck changing their approach to these alternative approaches. Gary Null, who's a well-known functional medicine doctor, has been butting heads with them for years, and even has a lawsuit against some of their editors because he's also being, you know, called a... It's just name calling. It's not science at all. And it's, unfortunately, Wikipedia is really the go-to reference for so many people. And yet, you know, if I want to know Britney Spears' birthday, I would look on Wikipedia and I would trust what they tell me. But if I want to know, you know, are there any good natural remedies for diabetes or something, I wouldn't go there, because they are so, so biased. So we haven't been able to affect a change there and just focus on developing our own research base. And organizations are noticing it. Like the Veterans Administration has now classified energy psychology as their, like, a second tier treatment that's, you know, perfectly okay doing it. It's not like you're going to get censored or anything like that. American Psychological Association, well, they've wavered on whether to give continuing education credits. But, you know, it's this sort of struggle with the organizations that so happens when you're in the middle of a paradigm shift. So the historical stuff is still ongoing. There's parallels, what happens today compared to what happened 250, 300 years ago. But huge amount of progress. I really think it's just a matter of time. Just one illustration of how much things have changed. In our hospital, we got some funding from a private foundation for staff to be trained in Reiki. That's another one of the hands-on energy therapies. And not only did the staff use it for themselves and for the patients, but also the Reiki volunteers would come in from the community and give free sessions to patients and staff, and people just loved it. And maybe this is a little bit biased, but the most impressive thing about all that was how many of the resident physicians, the physicians in training who were doing their residency at Spalding, took the program. So we had at least a dozen. I haven't kept count, but you know, beginning young doctors who now knew, felt, and used energy work, and it was like a really, really big thing. Just in terms of energy approaches for chronic pain, I think that the bridge treatment was acupuncture, because if you look at a map of the acupuncture points, which I'm sure everybody has seen, it's very, very similar to a couple of maps that chronic pain doctors use, because there's two pain conditions that are characterized by points of sensitivity. One is fibromyalgia, which has the tender points in certain areas, and the other is myofascial pain, which is sort of muscle, you know, not inflammation, but it's really intensification. And there's a lot of overlap, the points in acupuncture compared to those points. Those, the tradition, there's a traditional, not traditional, but a newer, but over the last 40 years, therapy called needling in Western medicine, dry needling, where you take a hypodermic needle, basically, and put it in the points without injecting anything and moving it around, and that it releases the myofascial pain. Ironically, it's exactly the same as acupuncture, but with much thicker, blunter needle, not blunt, but much thicker needles than acupuncture, and not nearly the refinement, but it's similar enough that some of the rehab medicine doctors, the physiatrists who did the dry needling, were more receptive to the notion of acupuncture. And actually, one of our Spalding doctors set up a course in you know, medical acupuncture for physicians based on that correspondence. So nowadays, you know, there are probably thousands of physicians who are trained in it too. So that's probably the energy one that gained the biggest foothold.
Maybe because it's a physical application to the energy pathways of the body. And I know there's even some schools of acupuncture who feel that it's energy, and others who just say that it's the soft tissue that's being treated. And then it's also a needle, which maybe doctors are more familiar with.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. It did have enough similarities that it wasn't that much of a stretch. But that's a controversy in the research world too. Why does acupuncture work? And, you know, there's good evidence that there's an important placebo component and there is a connective tissue element to it, but there is something electromagnetico, prana, chi, etheric energy that we still haven't got a full grasp on. So that's been one of the fascinating ways that the energy has made its way into the system. But as you say, it's very tangible and concrete, and that's different than just going like this. And there are two particular approaches to pain management with energy that I wanted to talk a bit about. That's the therapeutic touch one that I alluded to. A really important clinical interaction occurred, I don't know, it's got to be like 30 years ago or so now, but with a patient I was treating who had phantom limb pain, a very unusual condition. Most people are aware of it, but after an amputation, people have the sensation that their limb is still there, very commonly. Not so often, it will be painful. And it's painful in a way that doesn't respond to the usual medicines and whatnot. So it can be very, very challenging. So we had, you know, a fair number, not a lot, but a fair number of phantom pain patients in our program. And many of them did well and many of them did not. And there was one particular fellow who's in his mid-30s, a, you know, athletic guy who had a crush injury at work in the warehouse that he worked at, and he lost, I think it was above the knee. He wasn't responding well. So I said, let's just try something. He was open to it because, you know, he had nothing to lose and he was willing to try it. So he lay down on the examining table and I said, just close your eyes and relax, and we'll just see what happens. So I did this smoothing out thing, noticing that same sensation that you could feel between your hands. I felt that here, here, here. And then I still don't know why I did it, but I continued down over his phantom leg, and it didn't feel any different than the rest of his body. It was that same pressure sensation, even though I was, you know, his foot was like 2 feet away from his stump. So something was happening. And at the same time, he opened his eyes and said, "What are you doing, Doc?" Because he could feel me touching his phantom. And that there should be no, there's no, you know, medical explanation, neuroscience explanation for why that happened. He didn't know what I was doing because his eyes were closed, but he didn't have any nerves in that empty space. So how is that sensation, how is that perception relayed to him? So for me in that moment, I really came to see that the biofield is not just some concept, that it's a thing. It's an actual thing that I could feel with my hands. It turns out other people have had similar experiences, other therapists. Some gifted healers can see the phantoms. And by smoothing it out, he felt the pain draining. There's other ways of intervening. I guess this is an acupuncture point in general. It doesn't have to be needles. People know about the pressure, acupressure. There's also approaches using like a laser pointer, like a lecture pointer, that light can be an input that can be just as effective as the needles itself. So there's actually been some it hasn't been reported in the literature, but anecdotal stories of using laser pointers to treat the phantom. So you just basically, wow, you know, aiming the laser in the air, and you know, from a theoretical point, it does make sense. The phantom pain has been a really important conceptual challenge, because it's one thing to say I can feel it, but you know, people would always like to have a machine that can detect it, or a photograph. And the ideal thing would be a photographic image of it. There was some research on a parallel situation that first was done like 40, 50 years ago with using Kirlian photography, which is a way of detecting the electrical field around living objects or organisms they have to be narrow and fit between the plates of the camera. For a while, it was very popular to show images of like a leaf with this glowing border around it that would get bigger if a healer aimed energy at it, things like that. Somebody had the actually brilliant idea of what would happen if you cut the tip off the leaf. How does that affect the energy field? The results of that test were quite unexpected, because they found that the corona is intact even though there's no more leaf there. So it was a very important challenge to the model, because I think people assume that the aura, the biofield, was something that was emitted by the body. This makes it sound like the biofield is primary, and the body, the leaf, the cells somehow organize around that template. So it was a lot like the iron filings around the bar magnet that you probably did in seventh grade science. Where it's quite magical, that moment where you sprinkle the iron filings and all of a sudden they form this really beautiful geometric pattern. So the analogy would be, if you brush away some of the iron filings, the lines of force are still there. And that's the notion, is that the biofield is still there, even if the cells of the body, the iron filing analogy, are gone. So it hasn't been easy to replicate that study for some reason. There's a group of biofield researchers now who I'm consulting with to try and replicate it and see why it's been so hard to do. And we're trying it with, back then it was, you know, film cameras, trying it with digital cameras. It actually looks like something gets missing with digital, and we have to use some variant of film. It may be that the fellow who did the original studies had such a, and this is how what he described, such a rapport with the plants that his biofield magnified the plant's biofield so it was more visible. Whereas others in the last 40 years have been more scientists who are just trying to dissect and analyze and don't feel any emotional your energetic connection with the leaf. So there's a lot of potential research there. We haven't gotten lucky or whatever with outside funding. It wouldn't be a huge budget, a huge project, but I think it has really great potential to not just for the concepts of energy and energy medicine, but for, you know, treatment approaches and how to document and validate it. So that's one of my hopes, is what all this work is a springboard towards better understanding of what is the nature of the biofield. For phantom pain, it turns out this particular case was more straightforward, I guess you could say. Although actually not. I mean, I was going to say that it turns out there's a very strong psychological or emotional component to the pain. And in Jim's case, it actually manifested because as he felt the pain draining out of his foot, he asked me to stop the treatment. And I said, you know, why? It's making your pain go away. And he said, it's too weird a feeling for him to imagine that he would not be able to feel his leg via the pain. It was too disturbing to him because really that would communicate to him that, yes, in fact, you are an amputee and you do not have a leg anymore. And he was just not ready. His self-image, you know, whether it was macho personality or just a human being who was having trouble adjusting to such a major trauma. So he actually needed his pain. His pain served an important psychological function. Mm-hmm. And that was a really profound lesson because I knew what I wanted him to do, but that wasn't what was best for him. So, you know, I learned a lot from that.
Right. You're thinking, hey, I'm helping you with your pain. Isn't that what you want, is the pain to go away? But there's more to that.
Exactly. And we found that a lot with pain, that pain serves many functions that are actually valuable to the patients. And it can be something as simple as they don't have to do that task that they always dreaded having to do, that they could switch their roles and somebody else would take over. Or as simple as, you know, getting more attention from the family that ignored them. Sometimes it was simplistic as that, but there was often a very deep psychological meaning to the pain. And this became more evident when I shifted. There are a bunch of reasons I shifted from using these kind of approaches to these kind of approaches. But what I found was the tapping really effective in releasing whatever trauma or upset trigger the start of the pain. And again, with some of the phantom patients, it turns out that, you know, surgeons don't deal with emotional issues and upsets. That's not their bailiwick. So people are often left with dealing with the trauma of an amputation. And it could be everything from just the sense of loss and self-image to the meaning of the pain. So I had a number of patients who I would have them tap on whatever the issues were about their pain, and it would lead them to connect with, events that happened in their childhood that were vaguely similar to this, but not really. And yet in their inner mind, that was the link, and it was something that they had never resolved before. Or, you know, just the actual, one woman was very, it was poignant in a way, because the most emotionally disturbing aspect of her whole pain situation was the frustration and anger she felt having to deal with her insurance company to get coverage for her treatments. That was, she got so frustrated with them that that actually kept the fires burning. It literally fueled her phantom pain.
And I can understand that one. I think that the insurance companies have quite a monopoly in our healthcare system.
Yeah, it's really, you know, healthcare as a business, there's real shortcomings to it, and this was one of them, and it was just very poignant. You know, clinical staff will spend a lot of time on the phone advocating for patients, but it's just such a waste of time.
And how sad that the very system that's supposed to help people with their health was causing that aggravation, which was causing the stress and continued physical pain.
Yeah, Yeah, no, that's definitely true. I should add, there's a very humorous resolution to the story. She had developed a bone infection in one of her fingers because she had cut it and got infected. And the solution was to remove the finger. She was too embarrassed to wear a prosthetic finger, and then it just got so painful she couldn't put the prosthesis on. So after, I think it was two sessions of that, she showed me, she literally gave me the finger because it was her middle finger that she was missing, but she was showing me her, it was like she was proudly showing me that she could wear her prosthesis. So at first I said, what are you doing? it was pretty funny. And she was so pleased that, you know, she could go out in public again because she wasn't embarrassed. She'd gotten the authorizations from the claims adjuster or whoever it was.
Oh, good. So she finally prevailed.
Yeah, no, she did. But you multiply that by 100 or 1,000 or however many people have to do it, that, you know, energy medicine does have the potential of transforming the system too, because it's not expensive. It doesn't require huge investments of money like to buy machinery and things like that. And so much of it is, you know, person to person without technology. So, I mean, it has that potential, but I guess it's also threatening to people who own the machinery or sell the medications or what have you. So, you know, the politics of it is a whole other arena. But, you know, the phrase, we're in the middle of a paradigm shift. This is what happens, is that some institutions need to crumble before new ones can emerge. The tapping helped me realize the psychological dimension to chronic pain. And I've written a couple of papers on it. One of them is about, it's called Phantom Limb Pain, an energy trauma model, energy/trauma model, because really the trauma has an energetic impact. If you go through the physiology of energy and how it circulates through the body, that emotional blockages cause energetic blockages, and energetic blockages can be perceivable if they're big enough, and it can be uncomfortable and painful. So if you work through, you can work from the top level down and clear the belief systems, the memories, the emotions, the energy, and then the physiology goes back to normal.
Thoughts, beliefs, psychology, emotions impact pain. How much do you feel that impacts a person's energy system? And what have you found in your years of working with people with pain has helped to open the energy system? Because it seems like they're all interconnected, right?
It's all interconnected. And one of the important words in all of this is multidimensional, that human beings are multidimensional. And we function at the physical level, the energetic level, the emotional, the conceptual, and the spiritual. And different approaches are aimed at different levels. And different conditions require different levels to be intervened at, and different people, you know, depending on their belief systems. So you really, there's no like one size fits all. But if you can find ways to balance out and align the energy system, it makes a huge difference. And, you know, sometimes it's a direct acupuncture treatment, but other times it's like just going for a walk in the woods. It's not a medical intervention per se, but it has a big impact on your physiology. I remember, this isn't exactly the same, but I remember a lot of patients had insomnia. You know, you can understand why that might be, but the two most effective interventions that I would prescribe, if you want to use that word, was one, to not drink coffee after dinner, and to not watch TV news at night. And, you know, it sounds obvious, but people get so used to certain habits, certain lifestyle habits, that they overlook the impact that it has on their body. And, you know, TV news is sort of designed to make you anxious and designed to get you worried and frightened and helpless. So naturally, if that's what you're turning off at 11 at night, it's going to be hard to fall asleep. So,
and feel good about the world and your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, those also affect affect people's energy levels too. I mean, there's a lot of change in medicine. I think lifestyle practices are really, things like exercise and nutrition are accepted now as part of the mainstay. Meditation is, even at Harvard, they include it as part of the curriculum now, that beginning medical students learn how to meditate, which is, yeah, exactly. It's like...
Finally.
Yeah, it's changed a lot.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Herb Benson also, who hails from Harvard, did a lot of research actually on transcendental meditators and back in, I think it was the 60s and 70s. So yeah, it's there actually is a fair amount of research now. So I'm glad to hear that that's being taught, because it has so many benefits. And again, it's, you know, those listening might be thinking, well, how is somebody not touching my body going to help my pain go away? And like you say, you know, there's different approaches for different people on what will help them. But you're sharing what you found to be the most helpful. And if we could just circle back to EFT, the emotional freedom technique, as opposed to, as you say, this kind of energy healing, which is off the body energy healing. What about that do you think was the component? Because it's a form of energy psychology, but there's the tapping, there's reciting a phrase that's uncomfortable, and then it's being paired with an acceptance statement and love as well.
Yeah, that it's you've outlined the key ingredients there. And as far as what the key is, I don't think you can really say. I think it's actually different for different people. I know that when I first learned it for myself, you know, I made sure I found the right spots and did it in the right sequence and the right number of taps and all. And it was helpful. But after a while, I found that I didn't have to even touch them. I could just think about it.
Yeah.
And then after that, I came to real, if I could just recognize which memory or thought was bothering me, I could just release that. And ultimately, I think it comes down to what you're saying, that there's the affirmation of self-acceptance, which you start each session by saying something like, even though I still get upset when I think about that event that happened 20 years ago, I accept myself fully and completely. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that might be the most powerful component of the whole process, because that you're speaking from a wiser, deeper part of yourself than the little ego bit that's tied up in all these problems. And I think, you know, from some points of view, you could say it's your higher self, mm-hmm. or, you know, your inner wisdom. And the more you can align with that, the harder it is to hold on to these tensions and these stresses and traumas. So I think the physical stuff, the manipulations help, clearing out the energy helps. But ultimately, I think it does have to come from a sense of self-healing and self-care, self-love, self-acceptance.
Yeah, which is also a main component of mindfulness meditation or mindful practices as well.
Right.
Did you use much of that in your practice as well?
Yeah, I really enjoyed when every Wednesday at 6:30, I would do a group for the pain patients, and we would combine different things. Like sometimes it was more just progressive muscle relaxation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was mindfulness to be aware of the different sensory modalities, you know, what are you hearing now? What are you feeling? What are you smelling? And to just let them be, because we have the habit of grabbing hold of everything and analyzing it, judging it, comparing it, and just being able to sit and let it go is something else. We did energy alignment imagery, you know, the energy centers, the chakras, things like that. So, you know, I was kind of playing around with it. I didn't have like a set format or formula. But you could really see how once people found something that worked for them, it made a big difference. And, you know, the typical meditation of sitting quietly and watching your thoughts, that's not for everybody. Mm-hmm. Not everybody can sit still, for starters. So we would teach people to be mindful when they're on the treadmill, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, you could, instead of monitoring your breath, you can monitor your footsteps or find something to be rhythmic and allow you to get some distance. So, you know, it's great, the basic template, but then you have to be able to adapt mm-hmm. it to all different possible usages of it.
Yeah. Gary Craig helped popularize EFT, or really coined the term, is my understanding, although he built upon other people who were doing thought field therapy and applied kinesiology. And he found that people, not only could they resolve stress and emotional upset, but in many cases, people could resolve or improve physical ailments as well.
Yeah, because it's all connected. I think as I've progressed through my career, I'm more and more in the camp that psychological and emotional issues underlie just about everything. And of course, genetics has something to do with it, but it's not like the 99.9% that we've been sort of taught to believe. And, you know, sometimes it's pretty subtle and you have to do some detective work. There's one of the ASAP people who does what she calls herself a soul detective, S-O-U-L detective, because you have to really go deep to find the origins. But when you do, a lot of stuff can get released. So, you know, many people don't have the time to sit and meditate. Their lives are so busy and their priorities are elsewhere. And sometimes it takes something like an injury or an accident to break away from that pattern and step back and take a look. And, you know, for some people that's the way that it works. But we have huge innate healing potential. And I think the more we learn to tap into that, the better off we'll be as individuals and just as a society. And I think, you know, the COVID situation was another example where we didn't pay attention to innate healing possibilities. And I think it's just, you know, the whole society is really teetering on the brink of a whole new way of looking at things. So, mm-hmm. See how it goes.
Yeah. Because in energy medicine, you're really working with the vital life force of the being, or how would you describe what energy is?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. It is. It's, you know, every healing tradition around the world, except for Western medicine, has some notion like this, whether it's called a vital force, elan vital, or in yoga, it's prana, and acupuncture, it's chi, animal magnetism. So it's hard to describe, but you know it when you feel it, and it can be, there can be things within yourself, there can be interactions. We may have another conversation about what happens when biofields interact, because that's a whole other order of magnitude of effects that happen. But once you tune into it and realize that, you know, we're not machines and it's not just empty space between us, that there's something in that space, it really changes it. And it, you know, makes you sense that you're connected to everything. Where I'm sitting now, I can look out and see the woods and the hills and just feel a part of it. And it's just it's a wonderful feeling to know that you're not some isolated floating off in empty space, that you're part of something bigger. And that's healing in and of itself.
Definitely, definitely. And maybe why we like to be around certain people who feel good, or certain places that feel good, that we can feel the energy, or, you know, we're able to pick up on those subtle and sometimes stronger, if you want to call them, vibrations.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So in your first position as a psychiatrist, you worked in the VA with people who were experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder, and you've come to find that EFT is very vital for helping people with pain, emotional and physical pain. I just want to address a little bit about the research, because my understanding, like you said, the VA is now using EFT as one of its, I believe, one of its primary go-to approaches for helping veterans, is to look at the research. And I understand that there have been a lot more research studies on EFT and other forms of energy healing. Are there any that come to mind for you want to highlight today?
Well, I think there is some really, really solid research on EFT for PTSD, for post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think the best study was actually done 8 or 10 years ago. But, you know, it was people divided into two groups and their baseline measures were assessed. And one group got the EFT and one group got, I don't even remember what it was. They were like reading about something. It was, you know, it was a very different, or no, it was just standard of care. That's what it was. They continued with their regular ongoing treatments. And they had maybe 6 or 8 weeks of an hour a week EFT session and some home practice. And the results were so powerful that in the treatment, in the intervention group, after the end of that session, 86% no longer met the diagnostic criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder.
That is a phenomenal number.
It is. And that was actually a problem, because a lot of the mainstream docs just could not believe it. It seemed, yeah, come on. What kind of criteria? What questionnaire did you use? What criteria did you use? Who was it assessing? You know, but it was done quite well, and it ended up being printed in a very prominent top-tier psychiatric journal. And I remember having conversations with some of the, you know, the Harvard researchers on PTSD, and they were really interested. Well, do you have any MRIs of the brain to prove that this is happening? And because they would believe a machine rather than a patient's report of it. But there are some video clips on YouTube of interviewing veterans before and after treatment. And some of them, you can just see they're a nervous wreck before. They're like trembling and they can't even finish a sentence about it. And afterwards, they talk normally and about the events that used to be so upsetting. And, you know, it's not a placebo. It's much quicker than the cognitive behavioral therapies. They're cognitive and they do help address some of the dysfunctional beliefs, but they don't help you process the emotions or the energy. So there's a really strong research base for PTSD. For people who are interested in pursuing it, the National Organization, Association for Comprehensive Energy Psychology, has a website, energypsych.org, and one of the tabs is research. And you can be inundated with it, or you can look at some of the highlights. But this has been over the last 20 years, and it's been a priority, and I think it's worked. There's no way you can ignore it unless you work for Wikipedia, and it's, you know, it's not part of your agenda to learn as much as you can. So I really do think it's changing, and a lot of people are just, clinicians are just going out and learning it. And that's how it's not a top down thing. It's a grassroots thing that's spreading.
Yeah, it definitely seems to be growing. Have you found that there's a correlation between stress, anxiety, post traumatic stress disorder, and physical pain?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can have one without the other. There's the saying that pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. And that's just another way of saying that, you know, we go through life and stuff happens to us. It's how we respond to it that determines how unpleasant it becomes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's a really good summary of how we can affect those aspects that we can affect and make the pain manageable. Not, you know, not every pain condition is psychologically rooted, but even if you have a physical injury, how you recover from it can be optimized. And, you know, there are guided imagery protocols for healing from this or that, and many of them have also been validated with controlled studies. So it's good that these things are happening. It's good that the questions are being raised, and it's good that the research is being done to prove its validity.
Mm-hmm. And everyone needs to find what works for them. So, for example, if someone finds that a certain medication or herb, maybe in combination with some of these other approaches, are beneficial for them, that's something that you worked with in your practice. You're not necessarily suggesting that this is the only treatment for people, per se.
Correct. I don't think there's anything that's the only treatment for anything. But people do get into that, you know, my way or the highway sort of thing. But yeah, it's holistic approaches, and you know, it's hard to find caregivers who are schooled in all these different modalities and who can coordinate it. And a lot of it is self-education, self-training. But you know, the internet is valuable. There is a lot of good information out there once you find sources that are trustworthy.
Is there anything else you want to share today about pain relief and healing with energy medicine?
Again, people are multidimensional, and it's important to not omit the energy dimension, as Western medicine has done for so many years. I think it's happening. I'm personally quite optimistic, especially because I can reflect back and see how big the changes are. But I think the whole healthcare model is really going through a big positive shift right now.
What do you think will happen in our current mainstream allopathic medical model when it embraces more of these energy approaches?
It is happening, and you know, I think each institution, it will happen differently depending on the people and the culture and the attitudes, but it's
Rick, thank you so much for all that you've shared today. I look forward to our next conversation. We're going to talk more about group consciousness and your research and looking at sports as well and peak experiences, getting into the zone when we talk next for your next interview on New Thinking Aloud. Thank you so much for being with me today.
You're welcome, and thank you once again for inviting me.
My pleasure. And for those of you listening or watching, thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we are here.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday.